and you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you'd like to send an email into the program for questions with our guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com, khen.dj@gmail.com. And my co-host tonight is Professor Carlstrom, and our special guest is Dr. Tim Ball, and he has an extensive science background in climatology, especially reconstruction of past climates and impact of climate change on human history and the human condition. Heavily involved throughout his career in local and national committees related to climate, water, and river management and hazardous waste, a researcher, author of numerous papers on climate, long-range weather patterns, impacts of climate change on agriculture, ecosystems, and historical climatology. The most recent major publication, co-author of a book on environment, science, climate change, and fur trade, 18th Century Naturalists of Hudson Bay. So, Dr. Ball and Dr. Carlstrom, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Melody.
Great. Eric, is there anything more you would like to say before, you know, we talk?
Yeah, I would like to say that I'm very, very... Okay, I'll continue.
Okay.
It's an honor to have Dr. Timothy Ball join us this evening. He is one of the outspoken senior climate scientists who have been brave enough, really, to stand in the breach of this incredible propaganda blitz that would try to convince us all with Al Gore's movie, et cetera, and all the press, that the Earth is catastrophically warming and that humans are to blame. Now, Dr. Ball comes from he's considered the first PhD in climatology in Canada. He's from Winnipeg, Saskatchewan, I believe. Is that correct?
No, it's actually Manitoba, but right next door.
Excuse me. Okay.
Another of those cold Canadian provinces.
Right. Okay, excuse my error there.
Yeah.
So you have a long experience with not only the subject of climatology, but I would also imagine with this topic of what you would consider to be the global warming myth. I wonder if you could maybe give us just kind of a rundown on your experience with this topic and why you have come to the conclusion that the whole notion of catastrophic man-caused global warming is not a scientific reality, but rather a myth.
Well, it's interesting because when I got into climate originally, and by the way, one of the things that tweaked my interest was that prior to going back to university to get my PhD, I served in the Canadian Air Force, 5 years of that, flying search and rescue in Arctic Canada, and of course, seeing the incredible weather conditions and the incredible country up there was one of the things that triggered that, and of course, flying through particularly Churchill on Hudson Bay and learning about the records of the Hudson Bay Company, and they had thermometers in Churchill as early as 1768, and that triggered my interest. When I got into climate, I never thought it would be as controversial as it's become, although at that time, in the 1970s, global cooling was the consensus, not that consensus in science means much. It means something in politics, but not in science, but everybody was preparing for cooling, and the CIA were writing reports, and I must say I was as opposed to that as I am now to or later became to the idea that global warming was the new trend. There's a couple of things that have intrigued me through all of this. I've been called a climate skeptic, and I'm sure you're put in that category as well. The truth is all scientists are skeptics and must be skeptics. And so I take that as actually a compliment and shows people's lack of knowledge or understanding about how science works. And the other was called a climate change denier. It first occurred in the Times of London, England, about 5 years ago. And of course, what's amusing about that, it was meant as an insult with the Holocaust connotation of the word denier. But my whole career has been spent trying to educate people to the extent to which the climate changes all of the time. And of course, what we're seeing now, and what I've seen throughout my career, is the extent of climate change and the natural variability that occurs in it. And what has bothered me throughout the whole thing is that it got hijacked. The whole climate issue and climate science got hijacked by both the environmental movement and by the political agenda that came with it. So those are the things that have been, you know, have made it far more interesting than I'd ever imagined when I got into it. And of course, what has happened in just in very quick terms, Eric, is that they have turned the scientific method completely on its head. Science works by developing hypotheses which are based on assumptions. Then other scientists challenge those the hypothesis, but particularly the assumptions. But what happened in the case of the hypothesis that human CO2 was going to cause global warming was that it was accepted as fact before the research had even begun. As Richard Lindzen said many years ago, the consensus was reached before the research had begun. And so instead of disproving a hypothesis, as is the normal scientific method, they've gone about defending the hypothesis, but the evidence keeps growing and keeps growing that shows that it's clearly wrong, and so now they're getting into extremes over it. And what's troublesome to me is that the science, even though it's now clearly showing CO2 is not the problem, the politicians have developed carbon policies and cap and trade and whole economic structures, and yet there's no scientific justification for it, but the science is not an issue anymore.
Well, this has certainly been my experience as well, were you part of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at any one point, Tim? Or were you an observer of that process?
Well, I was never on it. One of the reasons, of course, is because when that was set up, and it was unfortunately a Canadian, Mars Strong, who was instrumental in that formation of that through his United Nations Environment Program, the people that they put on it were very carefully selected. And in Canada, they were mostly people who were within the government. They were part of the bureaucracy of Environment Canada. And at that time, I was chairing a Canadian National Committee on Climate Change and Climate Fluctuation, and we were having annual meetings where we were bringing in people like yourself, paleoclimatologists, and so on, trying to develop the whole concept of climate. And I got elected as the chair of that, and of course, one of my first points was to express my view that the jury was still out on CO2 causing climate change. And the next thing I know is that the government had pulled the funding on it, and I was no longer the chair. And that was the termination of it. And of course, it meant that I never even got approached to be on the IPCC. And incidentally, there were no academics outside of government that I'm aware of that were put on it. They were people that were either within government or very heavily funded by Environment Canada, people like Andrew Weaver at the University of Victoria. So the politics of it was there right from the very start, and of course that was done deliberately to predetermine the outcome.
Now, of course, many, many people have seen Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and he's gone on to win a Nobel Prize and an Academy Award for this. I think not quite so many people have heard of or seen the movie The Great Global Warming Swindle, but I would firmly, heartily recommend that to everybody, who's listening, to watch The Great Global Warming Swindle. It's a movie, I think, that came out in 2007, a documentary by Martin Durkin. And it can be seen on YouTube. So all you need to do is Google Great Global Warming Swindle, and you can watch it in pieces. And you're one of the people that's interviewed in that movie, so that was my original exposure to your position, as well as that of Dr. Richard Lindzen and Robert Carter and many others who are extremely credible scientists who I think do a very, very good job of refuting the basic premise of an inconvenient truth. Now, since then, I would imagine that you are retired, that you have been actually almost coming out of retirement on this issue. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, a couple of things about the comments. I appreciate the comment. One of the things that I do, by the way, think that Gore's movie deservedly got an Oscar, because it's from the land of make-believe, and whatever we feel about the science and the inaccuracy of it, it is a superb piece of propaganda. And very much in that category. What's interesting is that, as you also mentioned, he got the Nobel Prize for it. What a lot of people don't know is that in the week before the Nobel Prize was awarded to him, a British court that were challenged by a parent who said that his child was made to watch the program four times and that there were major scientific errors in it, the British court ruled that it was a purely political piece of work and that the nine major errors, that political bias plus the nine major scientific errors had to be put out by the government in a booklet to teachers that were going to show the movie. Now, what's interesting about that is, you could say, well, the Nobel Prize Committee couldn't have known about the U-Court ruling, but they could have known about, and should have known, if they'd done their homework properly, about the problems with the movie itself, because myself and people like Lord Monckton of Benchley and others were pointing these things out. Now, beyond that, Martin Durkin, who was a producer with Channel 4, a very well-respected documentary producer in the BBC in Britain, he contacted me about doing the movie, and I advised him on who to contact and what the major issues were. I was absolutely amazed about how well-informed he already was about the issues. But what was interesting about it was that I advised him at the time we were making it, and I actually, my sequences were filmed in Montreal. I said, you're going to have a hard time getting this distributed, especially in North America, because there was a previous Channel 4 production called The Greenhouse Conspiracy. And I urge you to look at that as well, Eric. It's also available on YouTube, simply called The Greenhouse Conspiracy. And it was made in the late 1990s. And what's really remarkable about it, and what's almost frightening about it, is that the points that it's making are still extremely relevant today. And, of course, what happened with that particular program, even though it was well-received in Europe, the PBS refused to show it, said it was too biased, and the BBC, or the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, with the influence of Dr. David Suzuki, wouldn't show it either. And so I warned Durkin that he would have a hard time. His comment to me was that he knew the head of Discovery Channel personally, that he would have no trouble getting it distributed. To my knowledge, it has not been shown on any television channel as a general viewing in North America. And in fact, Martin said to me later that he couldn't believe the vitriol of attacks that he'd had. I mean, he was used to that because his career has been made up saying, okay, well, here's what the prevailing wisdom is, but is there a counter view? And so, and not to be a contrarian, but just to say, look, on any issue, there are two sides to the debate, and I want both of them on the table. So that's how the Great Global Warming Swindle evolved. Is a very interesting part of it, Eric, about the politics of this. When it appeared initially, that documentary, there was one error in a graph. And, of course, it was picked on immediately and blown up. And so Martin withdrew the release, and I should tell you, he couldn't get any funding to make it. It all came out of his own pocket, and he was only able to recover from those DVDs he was able to sell. But he didn't put the DVD out until that error was corrected. Now, if you compare that with all of the major errors in Gore's movie, which are still shown without any adjustments, corrections, amendments, or anything else, and it's just another measure of the bias with this whole issue.
Yeah, and of course the issue is a very hot one, so to speak, right now, because our Supreme Court in the United States has just ruled, I think, that CO2 is a pollutant, which of course it isn't. And Obama is pushing hard now for a carbon tax and a cap and trade system, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing that as well. So this train has left the station in the sense that there is a gigantic political economic movement behind it. But before we get into the actual science of global warming or the misuse of science that accompanies it and cap and trade, I wonder if you could just briefly kind of summarize the main thesis of this movie, The Greenhouse Conspiracy, for us.
Well, the Greenhouse Conspiracy, it starts out as all good things do with an analogy, and the analogy is that something that's stable and well balanced is a Greek temple with its columns and its base and its roof. And the front of the temple is four columns, which represent the four major parts of the argument about climate and causes of climate change. And it of course is with the data, and then the scientific understanding of weather and climate, the CO2 issue, and so on. And what it does is it takes each one of those major columns and just simply shows where it just simply doesn't hold up under scientific scrutiny. And for example, one of the things that's in there is the work of Sherwood Idso. He and his son Craig run a site called CO2 Science. And they were doing early work on how increasing CO2 in the atmosphere causes the plants to grow more vigorously, they are shown in the movie how enhanced levels of CO2 are actually beneficial to plants. And by the way, you mentioned about the ruling on CO2 as a toxic substance. I was part of a group that recently we submitted an opposition to the EPA ruling it as a toxic substance, and I would love to be able to get power of attorney for the plants so that we could vote on their behalf whenever Gore and the others want to reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, because it's essential to life on Earth, and to reduce it would be quite harmful to the plants. So that was the idea of the Greenhouse Conspiracy, and as I said, it appeared briefly. And by the way, as the movie went along, as each column fell, then you got to the final column, it fell and the whole temple collapsed. And of course that is what is going on now, and has been further advanced by Martin Durkin's movie, The Great Global Warming Swindle.
Okay, so the documentary, The Greenhouse Conspiracy, doesn't really name a cause or a reason or motivation for the conspiracy, or who would benefit from such a conspiracy.
Yes, it deals with the science, and of course the key thing, of course, is the CO2, the focus on the CO2. Now, one of the things that I've been getting more and more focused upon is that as people start to realize how bad the science is on this issue, and then the focus on CO2 specifically, then the question becomes what you've just implied. Well, what's the motive? What's driving this? Why is CO2 such a focus? And why is the climate change issue become such a big issue? And by the way, one of the things I noticed, there's an article in the New York Times about this, something I was writing about 4 or 5 years ago. They over the course of my following all of this, they keep moving the goalposts. So we went, for example, from global warming, and when that didn't work, then they went to climate change, and now we're into climate catastrophe and climate chaos. And then they did the same thing with, it was originally carbon credits, which grew out of the original Kyoto Accord, and Al Gore, by the way, was involved with that, and the carbon credits idea, a key player in the carbon credits was Enron. And right. Then when carbon credits became discredited, then it went to a carbon tax, and then, of course, that became discredited. So now it's cap and trade, as if somehow this is something different. But actually, it's all the same thing. They're just simply different ways of saying, look, we're going to impose a carbon tax, and the carbon tax is designed to reduce the CO2 going into the atmosphere, and we're going to do that by undercutting and undermining the industries that are producing this CO2 through their burning of fossil fuels.
When did they change the term from global warming to climate change, by the way? Was this all in the same time period or whatever?
Well, Melody, it began about 2 years ago as you started to see it occurring. And of course, it occurred because of what Thomas Huxley described as the great bane of science, is a lovely hypothesis destroyed by an ugly fact. And the ugly fact was that they said that if CO2 increases, then the temperature will go up. But since 2000, the temperature's been going down as the CO2 continues to rise. And initially they were saying that, oh, no, the temperature is not going down. It's just a couple of years of anomaly. But, of course, now we're into the ninth year of a declining temperature, but the CO2 continuing to rise. So now, and, of course, the climate change terminology allowed them to attribute anything to climate change, whether it was getting hotter or colder, warmer, wetter, drier. This was all due to human activity and our causing climate change. And so it widened the scope for them to point at any natural variability and say, oh, this is because of human activity. And, of course, it's backfiring on them to some extent, because even the people that don't understand the science could understand the illogic of saying, well, yes, we've had colder years, and particularly this winter as an example, but they're saying, oh, no, this colder is due to global warming. Well, say even the illogic of that so it makes people say, well, hang on a minute. And of course, this happens when you take a particular position and refuse to budge away from it, even though the evidence continues to grow and show you're wrong. So you become increasingly doctrinaire and have to make increasingly ridiculous statements to try and maintain your position. And of course, ultimately that brings about your downfall. And that's what we're in the process of now.
Well, that's what's amazing just about using that term. It's just, I'm just surprised that people even allowed them to use it.
Well, of course, go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead, Eric.
Well, I was just going to say, in any propaganda game, the key is to repeat the lie over and over and over again. And so what you hear is, you know, polar bears and rising sea levels and hurricanes and malaria and all these kind of hot button items that you know, get people kind of worked up. And each one of those things can be shown. It can be shown that each one of those things is not, in fact, affected significantly by humans' burning of fossil fuels or emission of carbon dioxide. But it doesn't matter to the extent that, you know, kids are shown the movie and people are. I watch BBC News sometimes, and it seems like every night there's some new report saying sea level is going to go up, you know, way more than we thought last year, you know, that sort of thing. See, it's a propaganda offensive that is, when you start looking at it, truly astonishing, considering that it's all based on computer models and not based on reality. And, of course, the computer models, as Dr. Ball knows, are just highly flawed with the lack of understanding the climate system and many false assumptions, one of which is that climate doesn't change on its own.
So, essentially, our real problem is the press. certain avenues of the press.
Well, I think that the mainstream media are showing they show their bias, and particularly with regard to climate change. I found that the talk radio like this is far more open to different ideas and to listen to the other point of view. And of course, that's why talk radio, to some extent, is under attack. But it's really that the mainstream television that has been the culprit. And it was a Canadian that coined the phrase "global village," and I think it's very appropriate in that in a village, people think they know everything that's going on, and in fact, they don't. And they're always stunned when something happens such a nice man, I couldn't believe he'd do that. But the other thing is that in a village or any group in a human society, the gossips cause more damage and destruction than anybody. And I refer to the mainstream media in today's world as the gossip mongers in the global village. And you've got people like Andrew Revkin at the New York Times. And I mean, I've spoken with the man, and how can you continue to take the positions that you're taking? And of course, what you find out is that it's just a belief, and it's in his case, and I mean, so many of these people, it's their political view that is coloring their view of the science, and so they use their vehicle of the media to keep pushing it. Now, in response to Eric's comment, by the way, about almost every day on the news, there's some new event, and that of course maintains the big lie. People are saying, well, you know, we're hearing things that we never heard before. This is happening and that's happening. But it's a bit like it's when you're introduced to somebody for the first time. It seems like after that you either meet them or see them or hear about them quite often. They were always there. They were just not part of your awareness of things. And so the same is true of the weather and climate. That it's become a mainstream media issue, so they report every natural event that goes on as if somehow it was unnatural. And so I know Eric and people like myself look at these things and know that this is a natural event and want to scream at the television about it, but of course once it's out there and then in the mainstream media, as Roy Green, the radio guy in Montreal, says that nowadays they're repeaters, not reporters. So something gets repeated in two or three publications, and then it's fact. It's in the record, and you can't contradict it. So these are some of the things that are driving it.
Yeah. Perhaps we should just launch into a few facts, since we're capable of doing that, Dr. Ball. Could we just kind of set the record straight on some of the myths about global warming, maybe starting with the role of carbon dioxide in the greenhouse effect, what it's and on our planet, et cetera. I know you've written on that, but maybe can we just start with some basic facts to just kind of wipe out the myth, and so then we can get on to how it's being misused.
Yeah, well, the greenhouse effect, it's another of these analogies that is used to help people understand things, but as with so many analogies, it doesn't fit exactly, but it becomes so much a part of our lexicon and part of our language, like the holes in the ozone. When there are no holes in the ozone, there's areas of thinning, but it's become part of our language. And the greenhouse effect is based upon the idea that our atmosphere, or at least our world, is about 33 degrees Celsius warmer than it should be without the greenhouse effect. In other words, if we didn't have these gases in the atmosphere, the global temperature should be about minus 18 degrees Celsius, when in fact it's plus 15, so that there's a change of a difference of 33. The greenhouse gases act like the glass in a greenhouse. Now what happens in a greenhouse is the sunlight comes in, passes through the glass, hits the surfaces inside the greenhouse, and that absorbs that energy from the sun, which is shortwave energy, but then it gives it off as what we call sensible heat or infrared radiation, that heat can't pass through the glass. So the glass is in effect in the greenhouse acting like a one-way valve. It lets the energy from the sun in, but doesn't let the heat from the surfaces within the greenhouse back out again. And so, of course, the greenhouse gets hotter and hotter. And so that is used as the analogy of how the Earth's atmosphere works, but instead of the glass, we've got the greenhouse gases blocking or slowing down, actually, correctly, the escape of that heat back to space. There are so many problems with that analogy, but as I said, it's become part of our lexicon, and so everybody knows about it. Very few understand how it works. Now, one of the errors in it is that we talk about greenhouse gases, and you see this in the media all the time, and the EPA report, for example, talking about greenhouse gases and the Obama administration, what they're really talking about is CO2. But CO2 is less than 4% of the total greenhouse gases. Now, the major greenhouse gases, the most important is water vapor. It's about 95% of the greenhouse gases by volume and is virtually ignored. Then you've got CO2 at less than 4%, and then the other one that has some importance is methane. And of course, methane has been the focus of attention because of the people that are attacking particularly the animal rights people attacking the cattlemen and their cows producing methane and so on, to the point where in New Zealand they actually introduced a tax on farmers of about $300 per animal for the methane it produced. It's got to that point of ridiculousness. But so the greenhouse gases, the greenhouse effect, is a real thing, but it doesn't work like a greenhouse as they suggest. There is a recent piece of work come out by a professor, Mikulatsky, who is showing that the greenhouse effect doesn't change the temperature much at all. That it does cause the temperature to be warmer, just like a blanket keeps the heat on your body at night, but it's essentially saturated. That is, that it's working as efficiently as it can, and that even if the amount of the gas changes, whether the CO2 increases or decreases or water vapor changes, it doesn't alter the effectiveness of the greenhouse effect. This means that the total cause of temperature change on the Earth are changes in the sun. But of course, the IPCC that Eric referred to doesn't consider the sun in its studies of climate change. So that's the situation. The hypothesis developed, as I said earlier, that around the idea that if there's an increase in CO2 as a greenhouse gas, then the temperature will rise. And that the CO2 will increase because humans are adding more every single year. And therefore, as that CO2 increases, the temperature of the world will increase. And that became the whole hypothesis of global warming. The difficulty with it is that the record for any period of time of any duration shows that, including the ice core record, by the way, shows that the temperature increases before the CO2. So in other words, the fundamental assumption of the hypothesis is absolutely wrong. And to put that in some context for the audience, I've already talked about hypotheses are based on assumptions. And so they start out as theories, but if they hold up to the scientific attempts to disprove them, and they make accurate predictions, and that's an important point because science is about the ability to predict. If they make accurate predictions, then they become a law. So Newton's theory of gravity started as a theory, but once it proved to make accurate predictions, and without it they couldn't have put that space shuttle up yesterday, then it became Newton's laws of gravity. Well, we still have Darwin's theory of evolution, and we still have Einstein's theory of relativity, and we still have the theory that an increase in CO2 will cause global warming. Now with Einstein's theory, for example, one of the basic assumptions there is that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. But there are physicists that are showing that there are things in the universe going faster than the speed of light. If that proves correct, then Einstein's theory of relativity is in some question, and the formula E equals mc squared will not be correct because it evolves logically from the assumptions. Well, what we're finding with the CO2 and greenhouse theory is that as the evidence comes in, it shows that the fundamental assumptions are wrong, and the idea that CO2 causes a temperature increase has already been shown to be incorrect.
Well, one of the things that you've written about, and I've got several of your articles here that I downloaded off the computer just by Googling your name, and you mentioned, yes, 4% that CO2 makes up only about 4% of the greenhouse gases. The water vapor is far more important with about 95%.
Right.
But you also mentioned that the human contribution of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere is only about 3% of that 4%. So 3%
yep.
of the total CO2 would be coming from the burning of fossil fuels, whereas the rest of it would be exchanged from the ocean, from plants and vegetation,
yep.
et cetera, and that that we've now done enough research that we know there are many sources and sinks for carbon dioxide, and that fossil fuel burning is actually, we put into the atmosphere is relatively small to some of these other contributions. And so,
well, exactly, Eric. Yeah, well, one of the problems that we've gotten, by the way, the amount that we put up, the number for that is made up by, and I use that term deliberately, by the IPCC. They get statistics on the amount of fossil fuel burned by each country in the world, and then they make adjustments to it and come up with that figure that we produce in the 2007 report. It was the 7.85 gigatons of CO2 that humans produce. What they don't include is the fact that half of the CO2 that humans produce we remove by our activities of agriculture and forestry, but particularly agriculture. So farmers are already sequestering the CO2 that we're putting up into the atmosphere, and if it is a problem, and as you know, I don't think it is, but if they're saying it is, then why aren't we paying the farmers for that service? The human contribution to the atmosphere raises the other major problem in climate that you're very well aware of, Eric, and that is that virtually all of the data that we use are very crude estimates. We have no real accurate measures of the natural sources of CO2 going into the atmosphere or being removed from the atmosphere, as you say, the sources and the sinks. So, for example, the oceans, the IPCC say it ranges between 90 and 100 gigatons a year. Well, that's an error factor of 10 gigatons, which is greater than the gross amount that humans produce. And so when you put the human portion into the perspective of how inaccurate our estimates are of the natural sources, it becomes even more ridiculous. And I have argued, in fact, I did it with somebody today and said, look, if you took all the people off the planet, and I happen to think that that's one of the underlying themes of some of these people.
Right,
if you just get rid of all the people, it'd be a great place to live. But if you got rid of every human activity and every human and left one scientist behind to measure the difference in the CO2 in the atmosphere, she wouldn't be able to measure any difference. It is that small. And it also raises this whole question about for all of the data that we have are estimates, or even worse, they are computer model determinations or numbers. And we are now in the position, Eric, as you well know, that they are taking the output of one computer model, using it as if it was real data, and putting it into other computer models. So it's become a truly incestuous situation.
The echo chamber effect.
Just
another kind of factoid maybe people would like to try to understand. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually quite small. It's about 380 parts per million. And this, of course, is supposed to be the culprit in this catastrophic warming. But in fact, agronomists have shown that if we were to double, triple, quadruple even the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere to, say, 1,500 parts per million, that this would have caused the crops, agricultural crops, to grow, to increase their productivity by 20 to 50%. And I've seen studies that suggest that by burning fossil fuels, we have actually increased the productivity of the planet, the biological productivity of the plants, by 8 to 12%. So the fact is that CO2 is a miracle gas. It's a nutrient. It's a fertilizer. It's the basis of life because photosynthesis requires carbon dioxide and water and sunlight. And this was the greatest innovation, a revolution in the history of life about 4 billion years ago, which caused of course oxygen then to be added to our atmosphere after the product of photosynthesis is not only the production of sugars, which are food for plants, but also oxygen, which is then added to the atmosphere. So the plants are absolutely requiring CO2. It is a nutrient. It is a beneficial gas. It is not a pollutant. And yet this is what we're being told by the Supreme Court in this country.
Yeah. Well, exactly, Eric. And again, I mentioned Sherwood Idsoe did, and he did a lot of the early research. He's the fellow that's in that greenhouse conspiracy movie, and where they're growing small orange trees under enclosed conditions and pumping up the levels of CO2. He showed, his research shows that for most plants, the optimum amount of CO2 is between 1,000 and 1,200 parts per million, and then you compare that with what you just mentioned, the general atmospheric level of 385. The 1,000 to 1,200 parts per million is being used commercially. There are many greenhouses which pump that amount into the greenhouse to increase their yields by a factor of four, and it also has the benefit that the plant uses less water when it has more CO2. So there's another benefit to it. The 1,000 to 1,200 parts per million that seems to be the optimum level for plants appears to be what the plants have evolved to. If you look at the levels of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere, and there's a very good graph by Bernier that shows 600 million years of time, and it shows the temperature of the Earth over that time and the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. Over the last 300 million years, when most plants have evolved, the average level in the atmosphere has been around 1,000 to 1,200 parts per million. So this seems to suggest that the plants in that period of the time have evolved to that level, and that in fact you could argue right now that at 385 parts per million, they are malnourished. And of course, if as these people want to reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, it would impact on the plants quite significantly. You mentioned about the studies shown on how our CO2 has increased the yields. There's a very good study that showed that approximately 2 bushels per acre increase in wheat yields in North America are due to the rising levels of CO2. I have power of attorney and vote on behalf of the plants when they want to reduce CO2 levels. By the way, most people don't know this, but if you're in a room at a conference, CO2 level after the conference, after about an hour, the CO2 level in the room is up around 1,500 parts per million, and it doesn't affect anybody. The levels that are tolerable for humans in mining, where it is an issue, they allow people to stay in the mine up to about 4,500 parts per million. The length of time they can stay under those levels is restricted to about 15 minutes, but nonetheless they can. After that, of course, it does become toxic because, as Paracelsus said in the 1600s, the toxicity is in the dosage. But CO2 levels could go way higher and benefit the plants and have no impact upon the global temperature or on the humans.
What about these projects where they pump it into the they want to pump CO2 into the ground?
That's called sequestering, and it's a bit of a scam that's being pushed by the governments and the oil companies. in an oil field, they've known for a long time and have practiced for a long time, if you just pump the oil out, you recover about one barrel in four. If you can push something down to detach the oil and make it more flow more easily, you can recover three barrels in four. And about 30, 40 years ago, I know they were doing it in southern Saskatchewan, pumping saline water down and increasing the recovery rate. But they've also discovered that if you push CO2 down, it pushes out the oil much more efficiently. But it's a very expensive proposition. So what's happened is the oil companies have gone forward and said, look, we'll get rid of the extra CO2 for you. Give us a subsidy to truck it or pipe it or ship it and for us to pump it into the ground, and then we'll help you get rid of it. But in fact, what it's doing, of course, is allowing them to recover more of the oil in the ground and increase their profits. So, I'm not going to criticize the oil companies for that. Business is business, and if you can convince the government that getting rid of the CO2 is an important thing, then go for it. But it raises all sorts of questions, of course, and I've not seen any research done on what effect this would have on the groundwater with those increased levels of CO2 within the ground. But that whole idea of carbon sequestration comes out of this idea that, oh, well, we've got to get rid of this extra CO2 that industry is producing.
I've heard this is also a lubricant, but is CO2 again is released also when you have volcanoes and earthquakes. Is that correct?
CO2 is coming out of the ground all of the time. It comes through the crater with the eruption of a volcano, as do many other gases, and also, by the way, including water vapor out of the volcano, which is another greenhouse gas. And but CO2 is also leaking out of the ground for several hundred kilometers around any volcano. There were studies done on Mount Etna, for example, in Sicily, showing very high levels of CO2 at low levels. And this is why I have criticized for a long time the use of Mauna Loa right on the volcano, and there the soil is very porous, as a place to be measuring atmospheric CO2. It's the most ridiculous place you could choose to try and argue that that's representative of the global atmospheric level of CO2. Mm-hmm. And CO2, of course, is also coming out underneath the oceans because there's huge volcanic activity there, and there's geothermal heat being put into the oceans, but also CO2 bubbling into the oceans. And so, there are many, many natural sources, and the volcanic activity is one of them.
One other thing that I had heard also is that CO2 is needed. It brings the temperature down in this inner core. Is that with the release of the rocks or something? There's something that I can't remember how it was stated, but that it may be necessary in bringing the temperature down.
I'm not quite sure what you're referring to there, but whenever you get an exchange of energy from one medium into another, there is energy exchange. So, for example, when you perspire, the perspiration, in order for that moisture, the perspiration to evaporate, takes energy. It takes that energy out of the heat of your skin, which then cools the skin. So any time that you get a change, and with regard to water, for example, a change from a solid as ice to a liquid or to a gas, energy is either absorbed or released. And this is true of any change of energy, that there are energies required and it's either absorbed or released. And I suspect that's what you're referring
to.
Well,
I think is what I was hearing is that when the CO2 is released, it does bring the temperature down when you have these volcanoes and earthquakes.
I'm not familiar with that. I do know, of course, that when you get volcanic eruptions, you get large amounts of the sulfur put into the atmosphere, then it blocks the sunlight and reduces global temperatures. The most recent large one, of course, was Pinatubo in 1991 that reduced the global temperature in 1992 by 1 degree Celsius. There have been other very large eruptions in history that have had a huge impact on human history. I mean, the most significant one was in about 1470 BC with the eruption of Santorini in the eastern Mediterranean that caused a global catastrophe, wiped out the Minoan civilization, which of course then allowed for the Greek civilization to develop. The other one in more recent history was the eruption of Tambora in 1815 in Indonesia, and it triggered what was called the Year with No Summer, 1816. To give you an idea how cold 1816 was, they had snow in Connecticut into June and July. So it was a very, very cold year, and of course it changed the course of human history, because it's the first time that governments brought in control on grain prices, the corn laws as they were called in England. It had a severe impact on the Napoleonic Wars, the Battle of Waterloo, and all these other things. So these singular events are really turning points. But in terms of their effect on climate, it's usually only about 1 year of noticeable or measurable change on the global temperature. You can see it much less over 9 or 10 years. But usually after about a year or two, most of the dust has fallen out or has been washed out, and the impact on global temperatures is very quickly reduced.
Well, I had a point going back to the idea of sequestering. Perhaps you, Tim, have seen a video that's put out by a fellow Canadian, an engineer who made a video, excellent video, called Nobody's Fuel. And he says why energy is more important than climate change. And it's a 2-hour, 20-minute video with lots of information. But basically he points out that if we were to reduce our fossil fuel burning, our fossil fuel consumption, our carbon emissions, so to speak, by 80%, which is what Phase 2 of Kyoto Protocol called for, that this would necessitate that our incomes would go down by the same amount. He says there's a direct correlation between energy use and wealth. So by 2050, the original Kyoto Protocol called for a reduction of fossil fuel burning down to 20% of what we were doing in 1990. Well, if we did that, of course, then we'd be living at the level of the Haitians, something like that. But also, he makes the point in the movie that the carbon sequestration technology is still kind of something off in the future. But it would appear that what they're trying to do is try to liquefy the carbon dioxide as it comes out of the, by the way, 40% of the CO2 in this country comes from coal-fired power plants. So what the proposition would be that you would liquefy the CO2 as it comes out of the smokestack, you would put it into pipes, and then you would pump it into these underground caverns. But what he says is that this would increase the cost. You would take an extra 35% more coal to accomplish this carbon sequestration than you would otherwise burn. So you're adding an enormous amount of energy to solve this non-problem.
Well, I agree, Eric. And one of the difficulties with all of this is first of all, the problems that we've been discussing about CO2 as a non-issue and a non-cause of climate change. But then, of course, it triggers all of these other ideas about alternative energies. And one of the things that I've been shouting about for a long time is that they're not doing proper cost-benefit analysis on these particular issues, and that's what this gentleman's referring to. And it's at the point now where there are so many government subsidies at so many different levels of the alternate energy industry that it's almost impossible now to do proper cost-benefit analysis. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, you're not then going to make proper judgments, and you're not going to get a true listing of the potential side effects. Now, we do know that with everything that you do, there are positive and negative effects. I mean, where we've seen it carried to extremes is in the drug industry, where they produce a drug and they put it on television and they have to list all of the possible side effects. Well, after you start hearing those, you say, no, I'll suffer the disease, thanks very much. We're not doing that. We're not doing it with wind energy, for example. We're not doing it with solar. We're not doing it with the cost of, or the problem of transmitting electricity over great distances, and so on and so forth. So I think he's absolutely correct that that what appears like a solution and a money saver won't turn out to be that way at all.
Yeah. Well, going back to the issue of man-caused global warming, maybe we could get at some of the other fallacies involved. The story or the polemic, as one of your fellow interviewees in The Great Global Warming said, one of the polemic is that pre-industrial times the CO2 content of the atmosphere was 280 parts per million. This would be without the effect of humans burning fossil fuels, supposedly, and supposedly this was going to be stable. And then there have been ice cores that take the record back 450,000 years, et cetera, in Antarctica, supposedly that show that this was the high value for most of the last 450,000 years. And then the people who are doing the modeling, the climatologists who are, the IPC is referring to, are gearing all their computer models to a CO2 doubled world, which would be twice 280 parts per million or 560 parts per million. And this is seen as some kind of benchmark, some kind of terrible event that could overtake humankind unless we act now. Now, I know you have written some about the fallacies of even listing the average CO2 content of the Earth in the pre-industrial times. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, well, of course, the whole issue with any of these sort of future scenarios is determined by the trend line that you're using. And we see it with temperature, for example, and as you know from your paleoclimate studies, depending on the starting and ending point of the graph that you're going to use, you can argue whether the temperature is going up or going down. And so it was absolutely essential to them to have a pre-industrial figure of CO2 that was considerably lower than what they were arguing the current level was. And this, of course, then they could say, well, it's gone up this much, and therefore that is clearly due to human industrial activity, and this shows how CO2 is the problem. The pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million, in my opinion, has been deliberately created. It starts with the ice core record that you mentioned, the 450,000 year ice core record, and you've got several people that show what's wrong with that. It generally is agreed by people like I'm trying to think of his name, Zbigniew. Oh, sorry, I've forgotten his last name. But anyway, he's been working on ice cores for 30 years. And he said, look, they underestimate the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by at least 20%. Well, if you increase the ice core records by 20%, then it's up to current levels of 380 parts per million. The other thing with the ice core record is that they smooth out the curve. In other words, they take a huge variability from year to year that the record shows, and they apply a smoothing curve to it, which eliminates the tremendous variability, which is important, but it also eliminates all of the high readings. And a German by the name of Ernst Beck, and this is part of what I think is the manipulation, he took a record that's been known about for quite some time of approximately 90,000 readings of atmospheric CO2 beginning in 1812. Now, the reason they were measuring CO2 at that time was because it was not long after Priestley had identified oxygen as a gas, and they wanted to know what other gases there were and what percentage they were in the atmosphere. And so scientists were taking samples and measuring the actual amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. When an English scientist by the name of Callender got a hold of this record, which has a range of readings up to 450, 500 parts per million. He chose only about 20% of the readings from the very low level of readings. In other words, he made sure that the readings fit with the 280 parts per million pre-industrial level. But when Beck has published this stuff now and shown, look, here's the actual readings and here's the range of variability of them, you see how the data was manipulated. Now, the CO2 readings that are currently being taken around the world, the Mount Loa record, which I've already talked about the limitations of that because it's sitting on a volcano, Roy Spencer's just published an article showing that the CO2 at Mount Loa goes up and down very closely following the sea temperature off the Hawaiian Islands. That's what's dictating, and of course the sea temperature would determine the input and output of CO2 from the ocean surface, and that's what's really causing the variability at Mauna Loa, not human the human input. But Keeling produced the Mauna Loa record. He takes the readings and then adjusts them, and he's patented the method by which he does that, and that method is then used for all CO2 measurements throughout the world. So it's not surprising that they show a lot of uniformity, but in fact, when you take any single readings from anywhere, there's huge variability, but they eliminate the variability and reduce the average in doing that. So the 280 parts per million pre-industrial level just simply doesn't hold up to any scientific examination at all.
Let me go ahead and give the station ID. You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And our guest tonight is Dr. Timothy Ball, and my co-host is Professor Carlstrom. And we were talking about greenhouse gases and global warming and the myths involved with it. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I think it might be a good idea now to start talking about the world's temperatures. From what I understand, Tim, even though it's very, very difficult, some would say impossible, to get an actual average temperature of the Earth, people do it all the time based on, you know, kind of averaging out various readings. And the claim is, I think, fairly well accepted that since about 1850, the Earth's temperature has warmed up about 1 degree Fahrenheit or 0.6 or 0.7 degrees centigrade. But I think if we look in the context of natural climate change, we can see that, well, for instance, during the time of the dinosaurs and the Mesozoic era, temperatures would have been as much as 10 degrees centigrade higher during late Precambrian, when we had another ice age. Temperatures might have been, well, they'd now talk about snowball Earth, how the Earth almost froze over, and the speculation is that the temperatures of the Earth might have been on the order of average temperature minus 40 degrees centigrade, which is the same as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And then if we look at the last several million, 2 or 3 million years, we're in the ice age, the Quaternary period, and we see that temperatures have fluctuated wildly between the glacial periods where average temperature, I don't know, what would you say, about 5 degrees centigrade colder, or 6 degrees centigrade colder on average for the planet, and then during the interglacials, and we are in an interglacial now, the temperatures in the past interglacials were warmer than now, maybe 1, 2, 3, even 4 degrees centigrade. So we have tremendous natural variability in our climate, and this, of course, is not being talked about by our politicians or our modelers or the press.
Right, and the most recent warm period it was the Holocene optimum, from about 8,000 years ago to 5,000 years ago, or actually more recently, 3,000 years ago. And the ice core record from Greenland and other places shows that the world was approximately 4 to 5 degrees Celsius warmer as recently as 5,000 years ago than it is now. But you don't even have to look, Eric, at the ice core records and their sort of reflections of temperature. there is a Dr. Ritchie out of the University of Toronto took a photograph of a white spruce, a paleofossil white spruce that's radiocarbon dated at 5,000 years old, and it's about almost three feet in diameter, and yet it's sitting 100 kilometers north of the current tree line. And so for a tree of that dimension to be that far north, the world would have had to have been, say, 4 to 5 degrees Celsius warmer than at present. But of course, what they're trying to convince you is that, that not only is it warmer than it's ever been, which simply isn't true, but also that the rate of temperature change is more dramatic than ever, and that also isn't true. I mean, as you said, a 1 degree Fahrenheit in 100 and, well, since 1850 or 130 years or more, is simply well within natural variability of temperature, within the long-term record. And of course, that figure, and by the way, that 0.6 degrees Celsius or 1 degree Fahrenheit, if you go back and look, what they actually report is that it's increased 0.6 degrees Celsius plus or minus 0.2 degrees Celsius. So the error factor on that number is 66%. Well, I mean, nobody would ever use that as a meaningful number with that large of an error factor in it. And yet there it is in the IPCC report as, oh well, look, this is how much the world has warmed, and it's catastrophic and it's never happened before. And of course, when you go back 100 years, and you talked about getting an accurate measure of the Earth's temperature, the first thing is that they're actually measuring the temperature in a Stevenson screen, which is about 4.5 feet above ground level. So it's really only the temperature at that height. The temperature of the Earth right at ground level is considerably different. And what you're reading is the temperature at a certain height, and by the way, that's above most crops, so it's really of not much value for crop production. And when you go back 100 years, there are very, very few weather stations that are 100 years in length, and none that I know of that are using the same type of instrumentation. They changed the instrumentation, which of course is going to have an influence upon the accuracy of the measures and so on. So when you start to look at those numbers and how they've achieved them and how they're presented, they don't bear any examination at all either, as you're suggesting.
Yeah, I've seen you on a video or two talking about the urban heat island effect and how dramatic it is in Winnipeg as well as in many, 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 major urban centers in all over the world. And that we have certainly raised the temperature by building structures and putting in pavement, removing natural vegetation on the order of what, 10 to 12 degrees centigrade in some places.
In some areas, what's interesting about that idea, the urban heat island effect, the first person to become aware of that was a German by the name of Kratzer back in 1933 in the Ruhr Valley. He wasn't interested in temperature as much. It was just one of those serendipitous discoveries out of research. As you know, how often that happens, you're looking at one thing and you suddenly discover something else. But he was looking at the problem of air pollution in the Ruhr Valley because of the coal plants and so on. So this idea that we haven't been concerned or aware of pollution for until recently is not true either. But what he discovered was that in order to try and get measures of what was going on, he started taking temperatures and found that built areas, we use that term, the temperature was warmer than the surrounding countryside. That idea sat idle until 1952, when a professor by the name of Chandler at the University of London in England started studying the climate of London. And he actually wrote a book called The Climate of London. And he strapped a thermometer with some shielding on the front of a car and drove around London and discovered this what is now known as the urban heat island. That is that in the center of a city, because of the concrete, the heat from the buildings, the heat from vehicles, and the whole thermal dynamics of the center of the city is much, much warmer than the surrounding countryside. And so what happens in cities is that over a period of over the course of the night, the city gives off this heat and a dome of warm air forms over the city. It's dissipated during the day, but then reforms the next night. But because the weather stations were on the edge of cities, usually at airports, they were reading the rural temperature, and then as the cities expanded, and that occurred particularly with the after the war with the car, allowing people to live in suburbs and commute in, then that urban heat island effect encompassed the weather stations, and it was seen, it was first read as, oh, this is global warming, but we now realize that it was actually the growth of this urban heat island effect to distort the actual temperature record. And there's a very good study by the Australian Warwick Hughes, where he studied six Australian cities from approximately 1890 up to 1990, and you see those cities, and suddenly the temperature starts to rise about 1950. And then he studied 26 rural sites in Australia, and you just simply don't see that increase in the 1950s as you see it in the urban areas. So once you factor that in, of course, it virtually eliminates that 0.6 degrees Celsius increase that the IPCC are claiming.
That's a remarkable fact. Another thing, Tim, that I think people don't understand or need to understand is that, yes, the climate is always warming and it's always cooling. It's doing one or the other, and in long-term trends, short-term trends, et cetera. But that cooling is much more damaging to crops, to humans, than warming. And if we look at the medieval warm period, 1000 AD approximately, this was a period of great wealth. Temperature was 1 or 2 degrees centigrade higher than it is now. Norwegians and Swedes were colonizing Greenland because the ice had melted and there were pastures there. And then the Little Ice Age, which took over after 1350 or so, up to 1850, was a period of shorter crop seasons, more disease, shorter lifespans, more poverty. So of the two, warming or cooling, warming is actually much more beneficent, benevolent towards humans. Cooling is not so benevolent towards people.
Well, not only to humans, but to all the flora and fauna. The restriction because of colder temperatures and shorter growing seasons, and of course the animals living off the plants and so on. So yeah, it's very negative. And as you were mentioning, the medieval warm period, I mean, in Scotland, the 12th century is known as the Golden Century. It was the great growth of Scotland and the expansion of the clans and so on. And as you mentioned, the Vikings farming in Greenland in soils that are now permanently frozen, permafrost. So yeah, it was very, very significant. The Little Ice Age, beginning about 1500, and the cooling of the temperatures, and that was one of the things, by the way, that triggered so much of the failures of harvest and such interesting things as the colder temperatures and the wetter conditions changed the salinity, that is the salt content of the Baltic, to the point where the herring, which was the mainstay of food supply for the what's called the Hanseatic League, these great German economic princedoms, they started to collapse. The herring moved out into the North Sea, and where the British and the Dutch started to fish them, and then that led to wars between the British and the Dutch. But the collapse of those economies, you could argue, led to the Reformation. I mean, one of the things that you can quite seriously suggest is that when the poor people couldn't buy their way into heaven, then we didn't care. When the middle class couldn't, we didn't care. But when the rich people couldn't afford to buy indulgences to pay for their sins, now we care. And I've suggested that if Martin Luther had started his revolution against the church and the selling of indulgences even 30 years earlier, the princes wouldn't have supported him and he'd have got nowhere. And so human history really starts to make some sense when you understand how the climate change impacts the economies, particularly the agricultural and food producing abilities, and how people respond to that. And you've got short term, you've got the Irish potato famine as another example, and you can go through this. But as you say, and by the way, one of the things that led to the colonization of North America was that here were superb lands in much warmer conditions and the opportunity to grow more food. And so you get the Highland Clearances, the Great Migrations out of Europe into North America associated with that. And of course that's another of the influences of climate on human history. I mean, the Great Migrations, we had the early one in human history of the migration of the Negroid people out of Africa. And then we had, during the Ice Age, the migration of the Mongoloids across the Bering Bridge and all of the people in North and South America that migrated here because of the climate forcing that occurred. And then the most recent great migrations are of the Caucasoids, or particularly the Europeans, in that little Ice Age period, and the colonialization that went on throughout the world. So history only makes sense once you understand the climate and the geography that influences it so directly. And of course, as you're saying, warmer is better. And yet here we've got governments preparing for cooling, or for warming, and we're heading for cooling. And I jokingly told some of the environmentalists our only hope to adapt quickly enough is genetic modification, but they don't want to hear about that either.
Well, you know, let's maybe talk about the role of the sun. You mentioned that earlier, and I know there's been some very exciting work coming out of Denmark showing a mechanism finally by which changes in sunspot activity might actually cause warming and cooling and wetting and drying cycles on the planet.
Yep.
Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, one of the things that the IPCC, we haven't talked about their motive yet, but one of the things that people don't know is that in their terms of reference, it says that they only look at human causes of climate change. So they effectively ignore all the natural causes, and one of the ones that they particularly ignore are changes in the sun. Now, we've known for a very long time that as the sunspot numbers change, then the temperature on the planet changes. And basically what you've got is when you've got more sunspots, the Earth is warmer. When you've got fewer sunspots, the Earth is cooler. The IPCC have argued that they ignored that because there wasn't, that yes, there was a correlation, but correlation does not mean cause and effect. You can't do that. And that's correct. But now we've had in the literature since 1991 a very plausible and now increasingly justified mechanism to explain what the relationship is. And it's basically this, and we've known for a long time, Eric, that the cloud formation is a very complex thing, and we haven't been able to account for all of the cloud that forms. And we now know that cosmic radiation entering the atmosphere creates ions around which the water droplets form to create clouds. And the amount of cosmic radiation reaching the Earth's atmosphere is varied by the strength of the sun's magnetic field. As the sun's magnetic field changes, it allows either more or less cosmic radiation to come into our Earth's atmosphere. The sunspots, of course, change as the Earth's as the sun's magnetic field changes. So they're simply a visible manifestation of a change on the sun, and that's why they correlate with the temperature change. Because as the amount of cosmic radiation reaching the lower atmosphere varies, then the amount of low cloud cover varies. And that, of course, then determines how much sun reaches the Earth to warm it or how much doesn't reach the Earth to warm it. Therefore, it directly affects temperature. And so if we use the greenhouse analogy, that low cloud which varies with the magnetic field of the sun, is almost like putting up a screen in the greenhouse. Okay? And so that's what's happening. Now, I said the IPCC have ignored this. They said, oh, no, that there's no mechanism. Well, there is a mechanism. It was first proposed by Christensen and Larson in 1991 and then more recently picked up by Svensmark. And if the readers want to, or listeners want to read about that, the chilling effect, I think it's called.
Chilling stars,
yeah. That book by Svensmark and Calder is a wonderful explanation of this. And so their argument that this wasn't in the literature, wasn't peer-reviewed, simply doesn't hold up. They just didn't want to include it because, of course, it shows that their CO2 argument is completely fallacious.
Yeah, and in fact, there's just a lot better correlation between variations in solar intensity and temperature than there is between CO2 and temperature. And
that's
this is
right.
Brought out well in the movie, The Great Global Warming Swindle. The graphs are shown there, and it's very, very convincing.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And of course, if, as is happening now, the cooling since 2000, because the sunspot cycles, the 11-year sunspot cycle, what Larson and Christensen showed was you can predict the number of sunspots in future cycles by the length of time it takes to go from one cycle to the next. Now, the cycle measurements of cycles began, I believe it was 1715, and we're now in cycle 23, and we're supposed to be in cycle 24, but it's not happening. And the longer the delay before cycle 24 beginning, then the lower the number of sunspots are going to be in cycle 24 and 25. And as it sits right now, we anticipate a cooling comparable to what occurred from about 1800 to 1820 or 30, with a period of low sunspot numbers called the Dalton minimum. I think if we go another 10 or 20 days or more, then we will get into sunspot numbers equal to what occurred with the Little Ice Age and the cooling that came with that. And, of course, you have things like in 1683, you had 3 feet of ice on the Thames River in London, England, to give you a measure of how cold it was. And, of course, it triggered the fur trade.
That had to do with the sunspots, then, is what you're saying? So if we lack of sunspots would cause the cooling, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let me run this by. I'll just state it in my way. Maybe it'll help. He explained it well. But basically, when the sunspots have an 11-year and a 22-year cycle, when the sunspots there's more numerous, then the sun's magnetic field is more powerful. And actually, the Earth is part of the sun's atmosphere in the sense that we get the solar winds and the solar plasma from the sun. And when sunspots are maximum, we get more solar winds, more solar plasma. And what that does is it deflects the cosmic radiation coming into our solar system from supernovas elsewhere in the universe. Okay, so more sunspot means less cosmic radiation. Well, what does cosmic radiation do? The more cosmic radiation comes in, the cosmic radiation acts like condensation nuclei around which water vapor condenses to form water droplets, which form clouds. So the more cosmic radiation, the more clouds. So when we have a sunspot minima with less magnetic intensity, that means we have more cosmic radiation coming in. That means we have more clouds. That means we have cooler temperatures. And what Dr. Ball is saying is that we can now probably with fairly good certainty predict that, you know, based on the length of this cycle 23, which is quite long, that we can expect now to go into a period of sunspot minima, which is similar to what we had in the Little Ice Age. So the great irony of all this is that as the government is telling us that we have to, you know, worry about global warming, actually, and warming is, as we know from history, beneficial, is not something to worry about. We actually probably are looking at a cooling, which would be something that perhaps we should worry about.
Yeah, and Eric, just to reinforce that, you know, I probably got more attacks over an article I wrote in which I listed all of the benefits of warming. And I mean, I just got hate mail over that because, of course, nobody wanted to hear that. And the public have been led to this idea that there's absolutely nothing good about warming. And it's simply not correct. And it's certainly not true for most of the higher middle latitude countries like Canada. I mean, if we increase our frost-free season by 1 week, that's huge for our agricultural productivity. And if we reduce the length of winter by 1 week, it reduces dramatically our need for fossil fuels to keep our houses warm and so on. And, you know, for example, diesel engines in the Arctic, they don't shut them down in the wintertime. It's much cheaper to keep them running. And so a warmer world would be hugely beneficial to many countries. But cooling, yeah, and by the way, just to give you an example, Melody, of what's going on, they keep talking about, there'll be an increase of deaths because of global warming. In fact, more people die of the cold every year than from warming. And you, in Britain, for example, it's about a 5-to-1 ratio of deaths from cooling of cold than from warming. But what's really frustrating for me is the government could solve the problem. If we prepare for cooling and it warms, the adaptation is easy. But if we prepare for warming as we're doing and it cools, it's going to be a huge problem adjusting and to cope with that. And of course, particularly if we haven't developed adequate energies and reliable supplies and all of these other things, and then all of a sudden we find within 5 years we need it, and we simply don't have the lead time to produce that. And so it could have huge consequences.
I'm looking at an article in the Guardian of UK, and it said something about the climate change policies failing because NASA scientists warns Obama, which is James Hansen. He seems to be quite an advocate of the global warming. Is what is your position on that?
James Hansen is actually you have a law. I've forgotten what it's two senator names for a law that prevents civil servants from speaking out on policy. And Hansen, who is the head of GIST, the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and does all of the climate research for NASA, has been very public and very vocal about the whole CO2 issue. He was the one that appeared before Al Gore's committee in 1988 and made the totally unsupportable and outrageous for a scientist when he said that he was 99% sure that humans were causing the global warming. Later, off the record, he admitted he shouldn't have said it, but he didn't go back to the committee and say that he was wrong. And Hansen, since that time, has been very public and very vocal. Now, here you have the head of a U.S. Government agency. He flew over to England and took part in a protest with a group of environmentalists against the opening of a coal-fired plant. And spoke at that meeting. He gave testimony on behalf of Greenpeace protesters who did physical damage to a coal plant and said that what they were doing was justified. And so Hansen has been probably the most overtly political climate person on this whole issue. Unfortunately, of course, it's a political agenda. It's not a scientific agenda, and he, as I said, what's amazing is how he's got away with it. Whenever there's been any hint that somebody might rein him in, he's gone out and said, "Oh, they're trying to muzzle me." He did it. He said, "Oh, the Bush administration have tried to shut me up." Well, his former boss at NASA said that never happened. But it was already in the record that Hansen was saying, "Oh no, they're interfering with me, and where's my rights of free speech and so on?" Well, sorry, your own legislation prevents you from speaking out, and yet here you are doing it. And one of the problems we got, Melody, is that the IPCC, for example, is made up almost exclusively of people who are civil servants. They're within the bureaucracy, and they're using those bureaucracies to push their own political agenda. And it's really quite a disturbing trend, as far as I'm concerned, because they're not accountable like the politicians are.
I might add that I saw an article where I think, didn't that boss also lose his job over contradicting Hansen?
Well, there's been several people that have lost their jobs. Taylor in the state of Washington, who was the state climatologist, got booted out, and a couple of other people. There's recently been a guy in New Zealand, forgotten the name now, Spillikin or something like that, that he just got let go because he dared to say that he didn't agree with the IPCC. So, and of course this is a problem. And one of the things that's disturbed me, over my career, that I give a speech and I get, people come up to me, for example, a couple of Environment Canada scientists came up to me after a speech and said, "We agree with you, but we're afraid to say anything." Now, I have sympathy for these people because they've got jobs, they've got mortgages, they've got, you know, children and so on, but it's really disturbing when somebody's adherence to wrong science means that they're bullied into silence. And I think that that's one of the disturbing things about this whole climate issue, is that people are literally bullied into silence. They won't say anything. And it happens in a variety of ways.
You've had death threats, haven't you, Tim?
Oh yes, yeah. Now that came out, by the way, when Durkin interviewed me. I quite honestly wasn't going to talk about that, partly because I knew if I spoke about it, it might cause other scientists to say, "Well, I'm not going to open my mouth. I don't need that." Mm-hmm. And but what's interesting is once it got out in the public, I didn't get the threats anymore. And so by speaking out, it actually shut it down. But this whole bullying of whole segments of our society into either keeping quiet or taking positions they don't believe in is really quite disturbing in a democracy.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is an interesting question to me because. I'd be interested in your opinion, but how many of the scientists that are involved with this, I think people like Hansen, it's pretty obvious that he's kind of bought and, or something, but how many of the scientists that are involved in this do you think are operating because they're intimidated? How many do you suppose have kind of sold themselves out short because there's so much grant money? I think Lindzen in the movie says since 1990 and Bush the Elder, the U.S. government alone has spent $2 billion a year researching man-caused global warming, not natural climate change, but again with an agenda. So there's an enormous amount of money, and I've heard figures as high as $4, $5 billion, $6 billion a year more recently, which is an enormous pool of money. How many scientists do you think are really kind of just sold out, and how many are just been bullied into submission? What's your sense of the culpability of the science?
Well, the culpability of the science is quite high. I've watched this trend of funding, not only in climate science, but particularly in climate science and environmental science, become a bigger and bigger factor. As you know, the funding for universities started to be cut back in the 70s and in the 80s and so on. And universities suddenly realized that they could take a percentage off the top of any research funds that a faculty member got. And they justified it on the grounds that, well, we're providing space and we provide, you know, whatever support and so on. So there's logic in that. But what it meant was that the faculty members standing within the university and promotions and so on became as much a function of the amount of funding they were bringing in as it did of the old publish and perish arguments. And of course, if you're going to pursue the funding, and I'll just now only talk about the climate science of it, then you've got to put in, and again, serving on committees, assessing applications for funding, you've got to put in the keywords that are going to trigger the funding to you. And if the government are controlling that, and they're only saying, well, we're only going to fund the science that supports our political position, then clearly you're only going to get science or people applying for the money using those keywords. And then you've got the additional problem, Eric, of the publication, because it's what I call peer review censorship. If you submit an article to a journal, the editor of the journal will send it to what I call the high priests, that is those that are getting the funding and getting the publications out there. And they, of course, will see it as heresy and recommend that it not be published. So you end up biasing the actual amount of research that's done on these issues. And in climate science, there's actually a very, very small group of people who have really dominated the whole climate science issue. And Professor Wegman, in his review with his committee of the whole hockey stick argument, that is this idea that there was no medieval warming and that the 20th century is dramatically warmed, he named the names. He identified 42 climate scientists, pointed out that they had all published with each other. And, of course, if they all publish with each other, it's almost a certainty that they are also peer-reviewing each other's work. And of course, but you can't find that out because they will not disclose who does the reviewing. And I think that's one of the first things we've got to do is we've got to say, no, you need to tell me who's doing the reviewing. Because if you're going to use, a reviewer could destroy somebody's career, then under basic U.S. law, every person has a right to face their accusers. And so in climate science, it's narrowed down to a very few group of people, and of course they are the ones that work with people like Hansen who have control of the research funding. One of the big people in it is Tom Wigley, who is at NCAR, and he's controlled funding through that agency. In Canada here we had a Gordon McBean who was the Assistant Deputy Minister of Environment Canada, and had total control over the funding that went into climate research, and it only funded that research that they wanted to have done.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Well, in terms of the political agenda, I wonder if we can start to imagine what it might be if we, as we surmise, the Earth appears to be going into a cooling phase while our politicians are trying to tell us we're going into a warming phase, and to get us to cut back on our burning of fossil fuels, this is a setup for a calamity, isn't it?
It depends upon how you define calamity. I mean, you and I would see it as a calamity that if we're destroying our economies and for no reason, that's a calamity. If we're blaming something for the wrong reason and that's triggering global energy and environmental policy, that's a calamity. But that leads back to the group that are pushing this, because for them, a collapse of the Western economy is not a calamity. And one of the people that I've identified, and I regret to tell you he's a Canadian, Maurice Strong, this man has had incredible influence on what's gone on. Maurice Strong was a farm boy out of Manitoba, where we talked about earlier. His family were socialist, almost communist. So he grew up in that environment, but he then went to the U.S. and became an industrialist, made a huge amount of money in industry. But as he got older, and of course as it happens with most people that make a lot of money, they want to endow, they want to buy their legacy and so on. We see it with Bill Gates and we see it with Warren Buffett and so on. Well, Maurice Strong wanted to impose his socialist agenda on the world. Okay, now, he made a statement about 30 years ago in which he said, look, the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? And the question I pose to people is, well, how would you go about doing that? Now, if you think about the industrialized nation as the engine of a car, and that's quite a reasonable analogy because it is the engine of industry and the fossil fuels that they burn that drive our economies and our progress, you could stop the engine by squeezing the fuel line. But if you do that with an industrialized nation, people will scream immediately if you cut off their energy flow. And we saw that with the recent increase in gas prices. But if you can say, well, no, look, the byproduct of your industry, CO2, is destroying the global climate and is going to kill us all, then you can effectively shut down the industry. That's why CO2, which is such a minor part of the whole climate mechanism, has become the sole focus. And, of course, how did Strong do this? Well, he got into the United Nations. And Alain Dewar, who wrote a very good book called The Cloak of Green, and about 20% of the book is devoted to Strong, and she said to him, look, if you wanted to change these things, why didn't you run for political office? And he very bluntly said, you can't change anything as a politician. And I think a lot of people know that. But he said, I realized that if I went to the UN, I could get all the money I wanted and not be accountable to anybody. And so that's what he did. And he then set up the United Nations Environment Program, part of which was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And he wrote the terms of reference for that agency. Now, I've been on enough government inquiries, and I think enough people know about commissions of inquiry. Commissions of inquiry are used by governments to take the heat off. So they say, oh yeah, we're looking into it. And then, well, could you comment? Oh no, I don't want to comment till the report comes in. And then they hope that when the report comes in 2 or 3 years later that the thing's forgotten and the heat is off. But my experience was that, an issue would come up. The politicians and the bureaucrats would write the terms of reference and in doing so predetermined the outcome. And just to give you an example, I was watching an interview with Judge Warren, the Warren Commission, looking at the Kennedy assassination, and somebody said to him, well, why didn't you look at that? And he said, well, it wasn't in our terms of reference. And so this is how the government controlled these things. And so Strong took that idea, and when he wrote the terms of reference for the IPCC, the first one was, you can only look at human causes of climate change. So he immediately restricted them to that and eliminated all of the natural causes, which is why they don't look at the sun. And that is carried to the point where they don't include major changes in the sun's mechanism, such as changes in the orbit and the tilt. Those are not included in the computer models.
What he also did
was he said that you must write a summary. And the summary is released before the scientific report is released. So they do the scientific report, it is then set aside, and then a summary for policymakers is written by the bureaucrats. It's released, and then it goes back, and 7 months later, the science report is released after they've made sure that it agrees with what the summary has said. So this is like an executive of a company writing a summary and then telling the employees to prepare a report that supports his summary. And that's how the rules are written. And Strong wrote it that way. So in other words, he controlled the scientific agenda through that IPCC in terms of reference. He then organized the 1992 Rio conference where he sold the whole idea, and Kyoto came out of that conference, into the NGOs, the government organizations, and to the environmental groups. And that's where he took it into the public and political arena and gave it a life that way. And of course, it's now so politicized that the science has really become irrelevant.
It's ironic.
So that's, yeah.
Well, it's tremendously ironic. Melody and I have also heard of Marie Strong because he has Colorado connections as well. From what I understand, he doesn't have a college degree. he didn't go to college. So here is the man who's controlling the entire science of climatology, as well as lots of other things, without a college degree. What's going on here?
Well, he's actually got grade 9. Grade 9, right? And in a sense, you have to admire him for doing what he's done with grade 9, you know?
Absolutely.
But it is frightening, yes. And of course, if you talk to people that know him, he's an incredibly persuasive person. And by the way, you know where he's living right now? He's living in China, and he's working on a company, building a company with George Soros, who's one of his major backers, and they're planning to build very cheap cars in China to import into North America. And of course, now that China's lending all the money to the U.S., they'll have an easy access into the market. The reason he's living in China, as I understand, is because the U.S. government were investigating him and his son, and Kofi Annan and his son, in their involvement with the oil for food in the Iraq situation. And so Strong bailed out of the U.S., And the damage he's done is far and wide. I mean, for example, he was in charge of Ontario Hydro, which is the government agency that runs all of the power production in the province of Ontario in Canada. And they are now in such desperate shape that they're going to have energy shortages for probably the next 40 years, because he convinced them to let their nuclear plants go under, and he got them to convince them they should shut down their coal-burning plants, and he built some wind power plants, which are absolutely useless, and the only thing that's saving them is imported power from other provinces, particularly Quebec. But Ontario is in serious, serious problems because of what Strong did when he was running their whole energy corporation. And so the man has done damage every single where he's gone.
Isn't he a front man for Rockefeller?
Well, I'm not sure of the Rockefeller connection. They are all part of that, the Soros and that connection. And of course, I have difficulty with that because I tend to shy away from the, possible conspiracy theory. But I prefer to call this a cabal, which is the idea that there is a small group of very powerful people with a political agenda. And I think that that's what these people are doing, and I think Rockefeller's part of that. And, of course, one of the things that you've got to look at is the influence of Al Gore and Maurice Strong and their influence over carbon credits. The carbon credits grew out of Kyoto. It was originally an idea that the Europeans offered to the U.S. to try and convince them to sign Kyoto. It didn't work, and of course they voted 95-0 against Kyoto, even though Al Gore was vice president at the time. But in 1998, there was a meeting in the White House with Clinton and Gore, Ken Lay, and Lord Brown, who was the head of British Petroleum, and they set up the whole plans for the carbon credits program, and Enron was the major force behind that. And of course, the Chicago Climate Exchange is the major clearinghouse for carbon credits. And guess who's on the board of the Chicago Climate Exchange? Maurice Strong.
Right.
So everywhere you look, you see these few people popping up and controlling. And as Richard Lindzen has said quite correctly, if you can control carbon, you can control the world. And that's
because
what's happening.
We are carbon-based life forms.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
We give off carbon emissions when we breathe out. And so if you can tax people on their use of carbon, if you make a tree worth a certain number of carbon credits, yes, you control life.
Yes. And of course, the cap and trade is that's another of those examples of shifting the goalposts. It started as carbon credits, it became a carbon tax, then it went to cap and trade. It's still the same thing. And what will happen, and if you go back and look at what Obama said when he was running for election, he said, I'm going to shut the coal industry down, and I'm going to do it by putting such a high carbon restriction on them that they won't be able to operate. And what's amusing about that is that he's now pushing clean coal as one of his alternatives.
Yeah, but isn't that also an industry that Gore is involved in, is the coal industry?
I'm not sure. I can't answer that, Melody. I don't know. I do know that through his company at the General Investment Management, they are a major clearinghouse for carbon credits. And as I understand, last year he made $51 million off of that alone. It is also said that Gore will be the first eco-billionaire. So there's no question that he's making an awful lot of money off of it. Now, I also understand that there, John Coleman, who founded the Weather Channel, is talking about a lawsuit against him, charging him with deception, because what he's done is he has told people that CO2 is a problem and that one way to deal with it is to have carbon credits, and then turning around and selling the carbon credits and making money off of it, and that's false advertising. And I know there are talks about lawsuits along that line against Al Gore.
I do know his family comes from oil and coal. But we had Rosalind.
That's what I believe.
Yeah, Rosalind Peterson we had on last week, and she had sent quite a bit of information that showed that we had a lot of climate control going on and weather control going on. I mean, they just overlapped it and had been going on for a considerable amount of time. And one of the things that jumped out at me in that, and looking at the, that type of programs is that could be a version of human caused global warming.
Well, one of the things, this comes under the general heading of geoengineering.
Mm-hmm.
And, this idea was kicking around back in the 70s when it was cooling, and there were ideas at that time of putting up huge reflectors in space to direct more sunlight down, particularly into northern cities, to warm them up. And the Russians were talking about building a dam across the Bering Straits to block the cold water coming out of the Arctic, which would then warm the North Pacific and warm up North America and then right around to Russia. And so these ideas about geoengineering, what I like to point out to people is, well, if CO2 is causing warming, when it was cooling, what would they have recommended adding CO2 to the atmosphere, and then what would that be causing now? If you don't understand the mechanisms and how they work, you're more than likely going to do the wrong thing and create a bigger problem. So doing nothing is by far the best. But of course, one of the things that happens with these things is that if there's money to be made, and what you're seeing now, you see industries developing around all of the stimulus money that's going to alternate energies and all the rest of it, and you see companies advertising. I mean, Exxon have got ads on that are far more egregious to me with false information than their funding of climate research was. But this idea that somehow we can control the climate, I don't know how many people know, but there was a very large experiment of dropping iron filings over the Pacific Ocean, and the idea was that if you increase the iron content of the upper surface of the ocean, it would then absorb more CO2. Well, it turned out that the study, the initial results are out and showing it's an absolute failure. But that was done with no thought to how that changes the chemistry of the upper surface of the ocean, what effect that had on plants and animals within the ocean, and so on. So these geoengineering schemes are so harebrained, but they grow out of this, you know, creating a fear, and then people saying, well, we've got to try and solve this problem.
I would just like to add something about air pollution, because we all know there is air pollution.
Yeah.
And that there are air pollutants. The air pollutants that are identified by, the main ones identified by the EPA and the California Air Resources Board are things like hydrocarbons and sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, ground level ozone, particulate matter, hydrogen sulfide, things like that. And so, and many of these are associated with the burning of fossil fuels. For instance, the particulates and the sulfur oxides and the nitrogen oxides and the hydrocarbons, and the ground level ozone, which is a product of photochemical smog. So yes, burning fossil fuels does create pollution, and we all know that that can be bad for human health and the health of the environment. But CO2, and of course carbon monoxide is another pollutant, but CO2 is not a pollutant. So CO2 is probably beneficial, but these others are not beneficial. The EPA is supposed to monitor and help us to limit these other pollutants. But unfortunately, with all this emphasis on CO2, it's got us all, I think, just scurrying off in the wrong direction. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that, Eric. It's a very good point. And of course, people attack me and say, "Oh, well, you know, you're in favor of pollution." And no, I'm not. In fact, I'm totally against pollution. And serving on all of these government boards and hazardous waste committees and so on, trying to deal with that issue. But to further your point, in Canada, Environment Canada spent $6.8 billion in 5 years. Now that doesn't sound like much in an American budget, but in Canada, that's huge. While they were spending that money, they didn't even meet their own targets for reduction of air pollution. And so this is one of the difficulties. And there's another more longer-term problem, Eric, and that is that when the public realize how much they've been misled on the CO2 and climate change issue, there'll be a tendency to say, "We don't believe anything you tell us." And a lot of these issues won't get the funding and the attention that they need. And so that's another danger of crying wolf over these issues. But again, having said all of that, I will say that we have reduced levels of pollution. They are lower, in the same way that we've reduced the deaths from many of the forms of cancer. But there's such a focus on negative things all the time that we never stop and count the positive things that we're achieving. Sound like Spiro Agnew, but the negative nabobs of, nabobs of negativity, wasn't it? Yes. Yeah, lovely alliteration. We've got to start, getting out the information of the good things that are occurring, the positive things that are occurring, and instead of just focusing on all of this negative stuff all the time.
Well, I guess we better get our closing remarks here, and I want to really thank you, Dr. Ball, for coming on our program and enlightening our audience, and I want to thank Eric for, again, contributing as a co-host.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor. I appreciate so much having the chance to talk to you, Tim, and I appreciate what you're doing. You are upholding standards of honest science, you may seem like a voice in the wilderness, but I think that just from what I read on the blogs and I talk to people in my classes, and there's a lot of people who are getting up to speed, learning about these issues very quickly, more or less because they're forced to. And to have people like you with your background, your credibility, to kind of lead the kind of the counter insanity movement, I think is really, really wonderful. Let me just finish with a quote here by Nigel Lawson, "An Appeal to Reason: A Cool Look at Global Warming." He said, "The new religion of global warming is a great story and a phenomenal bestseller. It contains a grain of truth and a mountain of nonsense, and that nonsense could be very damaging indeed. We appear to have entered a new age of unreason, which threatens to be as economically harmful as it is profoundly disquieting. It is from this, above all, that we really need to save the planet."
Yes, I couldn't agree with more of that. Thank you for your kind words, Eric, and thank you, Melody, for the opportunity to speak out on this on these issues and try and answer some of the questions about what's going on. And hopefully we can keep some sanity and some calm. I think that gradually, and one of the things that's very interesting to me is when I started talking about, look, you're all being fooled, the whole world's being fooled on this issue, people would just laugh at you and say, how could that happen? This recent recession and the collapse of the whole financial system has made people suddenly realize, yes, the whole world can be fooled. Now, there were some people saying, look, we're heading for disaster, but they were pushed aside. They say, oh, no, everything's great. We're all making money and so on. Well, the same is true of this climate issue. And so it's a much easier sell now, thanks to the recession, ironically. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that as they become more and more extreme, that extremism will define the limits for the majority. And that's a standard pattern in history, that a new paradigm, a new idea, environmentalism, very essential, very important, many people wanting to know, well, how far do we go with this? And then the extremists define the limits for everybody. And so they start doing things that people say, no, 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 now we're losing more than we're gaining. And that's the situation that we're in right now. And hopefully we can settle down and deal with the issues. And hopefully too much credibility of science won't be lost before the whole thing's over. So I thank you for this opportunity.
And I hope we can have you back again sometime. And
I would love to come back.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Tim, and good night, Melody, and good night, Tim.
Yeah. Good night.
Thank you.